May God's Spirit touch our hearts, our minds, and our lives. Amen. Please be seated. Well, this is my last sermon, so I'm giving myself permission to play a little. I want to talk about Transfiguration, it being the Feast of the Transfiguration and all, and not least the name of the parish from which the next David comes, but we'll just pass over that quietly for a moment and return there later. So Transfiguration, what on earth do you do with Transfiguration? I mean, how do you deal with a story like this? People go up mountains and they start to glow, and then they stop glowing and they come down again. Well, that's fine, but not an immense amount of use. There's an analogy that says if you take one of those boring things to you know, and you go up to a tree and you go, and this little tube goes into the tree and then you pull it out, you've got all the tree rings in a line, and it's like you have a stick with all these stripes on. And every little stripe goes all the way up the tree. In a way, the life of Jesus, the revelation of Jesus, is like Jesus' life is like a borehole into the nature of God. And every little thing you see in Jesus, every little mark in the story of his life, is like a stripe on that sample. And it goes all the way up through God and is always true of the divine. So the story of the Transfiguration, which we often see as one of the really slightly odd events in Jesus' life in a straight line, is actually a revelation of something which is permanently true about the nature of God. So Transfiguration is more than just a one-off. So I want to tell you, to help us work out what that means. So it's great, I'm just giving you a nice piece of flexible theology, so what do you do with it? So I'm going to tell you two stories of Transfiguration, and we're going to move on with this. So the first story is set in northern Italy shortly after the Second War, and it's set in a little village in the Po Valley, which runs down from the Alps, and the village is a small town just up towards the Alps on the pathway from the north, from Austria and Switzerland and Germany and everywhere else, down this river valley towards Italy. And the village is not a great village, it's not a great big town, it's a small town, and they have a square in the middle of the town, and off this one side of the square is the church. And the church is not a great church, it's a nice church, it's a pleasant church, it's a square church, and it has a lovely domed roof, a shallow dome, which echoes some of the great and glorious churches that are in the big cities. And on top of the dome is an angel. And the priest of this parish is called Don Camillo. And Don Camillo, so there's a laugh, some people know this. Don Camillo loves this church, and he loves his congregation, he loves the town. He's been there for years, for decades. He hates the angel. He's always hated the angel from the first time he came, and every year his hatred for it has deepened because it's ugly. It sits there looking horrible. It's a kind of browny gray, it's a lumpy. He thinks it was sculpted by a blind, one-armed person. And it sits there, and he's always been upset about it. Finally, he comes to the point in his life where he says, we have to do something. And he preaches a sermon in his church. He says, we have to do something about this angel. This angel is ugly. It is a disgrace to the church. It is a disgrace to the village. It is a disgrace to God. We must take this angel down and put a proper angel in its place. We shall have an angel cast by one of the bronze sculptors in Rome. And for this, we will need money. So I'm making a collection. And everybody goes, backs off a little bit. For several weeks, he works away at this, but there's not much progress. People in the village have grown used to the angel. It's not a beautiful angel, but it's our angel. It's kind of like us. Not great, not bad, it's there. Leave it alone. But Don Camillo's urge to get this done, to glorify the church, to glorify God, to raise the profile of the town, is so great that he finally calls a whole village meeting. Everybody in the town, in the villages around them, all invited to come. And he does this great speech about how this should be changed. And then he's expecting applause, and there's this big silence. And into the silence walks Pepone, the communist mayor of the village, carrying a ladder and a hammer. And he walks up to Don Camillo. And these people have been fencing with each other for ages. They do not like each other. He walks up to Don Camillo in the silence of the square and he says, "Why don't you take it down?" Don Camillo is a short man, a plump man, an older man, a man with little legs and little arms and a bald head. And he realizes with mounting embarrassment and rage that the mayor is humiliating him. "Put the ladder up," he says to the mayor. And the mayor, Pepone, says, "My pleasure." Walks up, puts the ladder up against the roof. He hands Don Camillo the hammer. Don Camillo is now trapped. He has no choice but to go up. So up he goes, very carefully climbing a ladder as people unused to ladders do. And at the top, with great care and fear and trembling, he transfers off the ladder onto the sloping roof of the dome. And then on all fours, crawls up the lovely orangey brown tiles till he's underneath the angel. And then with even greater care, raises himself up, fearful of falling with the hammer, and looks up at the angel, which suddenly is extremely big, close up. And he thinks to himself, "Start small, start small." So he looks at the outstretched hand of the angel, which is over his head, and gingerly with his hammer he hits it. And there's an explosion of dirt falls into his eyes and lands on his head. And he crouches down, drops the hammer, and protects himself as this stuff falls out. And in the moment of silence that follows, he hears a gasp from all the people in the square, and somebody shouts, "More!" And then others take up the cry, and it's "More! More! More!" And anxiously he picks up the hammer and stands up again, fearfully looks up at the hand. And where there was an ugly clay hand, there is a slender golden hand. He knocks some more off the arm, and then from a leg. And the cheering in the square gets louder and louder. Finally, he looks up at the angel's head and holds the hammer and thinks, "Can you hit an angel on the head?" But he says some Hail Marys and gives it a firm tap, and the last great lump of clay splits and reveals a beautiful golden angel. And the face of the angel is looking down at Don Camillo, and the simple beauty of this face is so great, it brings tears to his eyes. Don Camillo climbs down the ladder to great applause. That night in the square, there's a great party. Tables are brought out. All the food in the village is eaten. People come from far away. You've heard in the course of the day about this. And there's this great party. And as the party's going on, Don Camillo stands up. And everybody falls into silence, expecting him to say something wise and profound. But he picks up the hammer, and he walks across from his table, where all the church people are sitting. He walks across the square to the very far side, where the mayor and the communists are sitting. And he walks up to Pepone, who stands up. And he hands him the hammer. And as he hands him the hammer, he reaches out his hand for Pepone's shoulder, and he reaches out his hand for the priest's shoulder. and they embrace. And there is applause through the village. For on this day they have seen two things that were there all the time, but they never believed or imagined could be true. That beneath the ugly stone angel, there was a statue of immense beauty. And that between the mayor and the priest, there could at last be friendship. The angel perhaps had been covered with clay, because as armies had come and gone up and down that valley, somebody one day had covered it with the ugliest clay cover they could manage, so that it would be saved and one day discovered. This is a story of transfiguration. To see what could not be seen. To find what was unimaginable to find. To overcome a division that could not be overcome. Can you see what God sees? Could you have seen this coming? Could you have believed or hoped? But it was that moment of transfiguration that revealed it. So I have another story of transfiguration. This is one of my stories, this is a true story. About 25 years ago, when I was young and had more certainties than it is good for anyone to have, I was a chaplain at a university. And one of my colleagues in ministry, an older priest called Dick, phoned me up and said, I've got a medical appointment tomorrow. Could you please come and do my midweek Eucharist at the church? It's very small. And because I couldn't really come up fast enough with a good excuse, I said yes, but reluctantly. And I went that day up to his church, his old church, and the Eucharist was in the side chapel. And the side chapel had seats for about 20, all facing the altar, which was right up against the wall in the old-fashioned style with a stained glass window above it facing east. And it was a little altar, about a quarter of the size of ours here. And the congregation were sitting as if they had been intentionally placed more than an arm's reach from each other. It was like a congregation gathering in the times of the plague, no contact. And they were all old and wobbly. So I turned, we got on with the service. It was a said Book of Common Prayer Eucharist, and I was not very fond of the Book of Common Prayer. I felt really the best thing that could be done with the Common Prayer book was to set fire to it, but that's an aside. So I was there at the altar with my back to the congregation, shouting through the wall to God, who must be on the other side listening with his ear up against the stone, because that's what the whole thing implied. And in the middle of one of the long, boring prayers, I had another dialogue going on with God in which I was saying, God, what are we doing here with this dead liturgy and these nearly dead people? Why are we here? Of course, God never replies to these things. So the service rolled along, and then it comes to one of those places where in the eastward facing thing, the priest turns around and says something. I can't remember which bit it was, but as I turned around and looked at these eight people, in the flash of an eye, in an instant, a brief moment, I saw a 35-year-old woman and a 40-year-old man and a 20-year-old man. And I saw these, they weren't old crumblies anymore. They were, God showed me them in my visual language, them at their best, at their peak. He showed me what he saw. Like that sample of wood out of the tree, God is eternal. God doesn't see you today. God doesn't look at you and see you as you are today. God, who is eternal, sees you from your birth, up and before, all the way through your life and to your death and beyond. And this is The eternal God sees the whole of you and holds all that. And on that day, he kind of squished that up to represent everything he sees that was and could be and could have been in those people. He sees them as he made them, good and capable of bearing his image. This is a story of transfiguration, and it changed me. I even like the BCP now. Transfiguration is not just a story in this gospel. Transfiguration isn't something that happened a long time ago. Transfiguration is an eternal quality of God. It's a piece of the spirituality that we're invited into. And I think transfiguration is something that we need to practice, like we practice love, or we practice forgiveness, or we practice hope. Transfiguration is to be practiced. And the practice of transfiguration is to look not simply at what is in front of you immediately now, but look at something or someone and expand. And remember, this person was once a playful four-year-old who laughed, splashing in water in the sunlight on a summer's day. This person was once young and in love. This person will be old and wise. This person has experienced things that you never could imagine. Look at the person and look into that wholeness. Look at the event that has just happened to you one day as you're walking down a street or you're at work or just something that comes to you on television. And again, look into it, look through it, use it as a peephole onto a wider world or a lens to focus something. Transfigurations are there. We often don't notice them. They come in a flash and are easily missed. And transfigurations have a sense of suddenness and often a sense of humor about them as well, like a joke. Something happens and you think, oh no, but it's actually an oh yes. The person who gets an illness says, oh no. But sometimes that illness is life-changing and opens tremendous grace and possibility. Transformations, transfigurations are about us. So my invitation to you is practice the spirituality of transfigurations revealed in this reading. Jesus only radiated light for a moment. The disciples were terrified, and they were so pleased when he came back ordinary, tapped them on the shoulders, up lads, come on, up, it's all over, come on, get up, chickens. And it was just Jesus, him alone. But they never forgot it. And they never saw Jesus the same way again. It changed their view of him, though he continued to look just the same. And it was remembered and taught, and Peter tells others about it. You need to practice transfiguration spirituality. Keep your eyes open, your heart open. Think deeper, look more widely, and allow yourself to be changed moment by moment. There will be a transfiguration here in the course of the next 7 days. The David you see before you will be transfigured into another David. A younger, faster, smarter, and better looking David. Practice transfiguration theology with your clergy. Look at them, listen to them, look through them, listen beyond what is said. Listen to what God is saying to you through the teaching of the preacher. Megan will stand and preach here. Others will stand and preach here. And while all of us have our own skills and gifts and general loveliness or irritation, the things that make you wince, finally, your skill must be to listen through us and look through us and not so much see us, but to see how God is trying to talk to you, to touch you, to lead you, to challenge you, to heal you, to comfort, to forgive you. What, week by week, is God at work through the leadership of this church, through the clergy, through the music of the choir, through everything that happens? Transfiguration is the invitation to notice more deeply. May you be blessed to be not only the people of the Redeemer, but the people who practice transfiguration. Amen.